he does not necessarily believe in torture.
Not necessarily.
Or waterboarding.
Or waterboarding? Is there a difference? Oh, Mr. President.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not today.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, People Powered Radio in LA. In Oregon on 91.7 FM, KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM, Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM, WLRI News Watch. In Hawaii on 88.5 FM, KAKU, the voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio, on the Green Renaissance Network, WGRN 94.1 FM. In Palenville, New York, on 102.9 FM, WLPP. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul, on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're also streaming coast to coast and around the globe every day of the week on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com, now celebrating our 12th anniversary in our 13th year of troublemaking and muckraking. Thanks to those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do that each and every day. Well, here's a funny item. As it turns out, Jared Kushner, the president of the United States, son-in-law and one of Donald Trump's closest White House advisors, is registered to vote in both New Jersey and New York. Imagine that. And also, White House press secretary Sean Spicer, turns out he is also on the rolls in both Virginia and his home state of Rhode Island. That's according to election officials and voting registration records. Their dual registration, of course, offers two more high-profile examples of how common it is for voters to be on the rolls in multiple states, which Donald Trump has claimed to be evidence of voter fraud, which it is not. It is not illegal to be on the voter rolls in two separate states. It's illegal to vote in two separate states. But Donald Trump has called for a major investigation of voter fraud, including, as he notes, people who are registered in two separate states, people like his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his press secretary, Sean Spicer, apparently. Also, as we noted yesterday, White House chief strategist Steve Bannon is registered in two states. Oh, so is Donald Trump's daughter, Tiffany, registered in two states. Oh, so is Treasury Secretary nominee Steve Mnuchin, also registered in two separate states. White House officials did not respond to requests for comments from Washington Post when this was discovered.
So he could start that investigation right now in his own home.
Oh, it'd be easy.
Just
in his own
turn
home.
Right next door.
Would never have to leave. That's right. He could find all of these voter fraud criminals. Of course, they keep citing, and I won't go through this again today. I just wanted to point that out. But he keeps citing this 2012 Pew Center study showing that some 2.75 million people are registered in more than one state, largely because when they move, they don't call the old state and unregister. It is not evidence of fraud. The study itself did not cite any of that as evidence of voter fraud at all, despite what Donald Trump continues to say about that study. And the author of that study has said as much time and time and time again. Stop citing my study for evidence of voter fraud because it is not that. So that happened. I'm sure we'll find out tomorrow. Melania is registered to vote in two states, maybe even two countries. Maybe she's not even a citizen. Has anybody checked her birth certificate, by the way? Is she allowed to be first lady without being born a natural born citizen? Just asking. I'm just asking these questions. Anyway, hey, good news coming up. Take heart. It's been a hard week. This has been a very tough week over the past week.
The week that feels like it lasted a year.
Oh my God. Yes. So it has been a very tough week. I think we're going to have more ahead. So for this moment, for this blessed moment, I'm going to try to find some good news today, something to be encouraged about. I've got a few stories that offer some ray of hope, some light at the end of the tunnel. One of those might be we might be able to take heart from some lessons that maybe we can learn from Australia about what happened to their national healthcare law after conservatives took over the government some years ago. That may offer some light in the darkness when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, and its fate under the Republicans, who have vowed to repeal and replace it, even though they still cannot seem to come up with anything so far to replace it, at least anything that would avoid millions of Americans losing their health care or being forced to pay a lot more for it. Anyway, the Australian lesson, which may be useful to both Republicans and Democrats alike, that is coming up in a bit. That may be something to feel good about. We'll find out with my guest. Here's something that, I kind of feel good about. I don't know if Donald Trump does, but President Donald Trump, who is famously touchy about his approval ratings, he's not doing well. He's not doing well on that front. A new Quinnipiac University poll puts his approval ratings among American voters at 36%. 36% approval rating. A little bit less among women. 33% of women approve. In Barack Obama's presidency, in Quinnipiac's first poll there, you'll be surprised to hear that Barack Obama's numbers were much, much larger than Donald Trump's. Again, Obama stood at 59% in the first poll of his presidency from Quinnipiac, 59% compared to just a teeny tiny little bitty itty bitty 36% approval for Trump. So that's encouraging. However, GOP lawmakers who might want to, you know, consider distancing themselves from this wildly unpopular president, well, they may not be in such a rush to do that, because if you look at Trump's approval rating among just Republicans right now, 81%.
Wow.
Yeah. No kidding.
So 81%. Republicans approve of Donald Trump by a margin of 81%.
Not a margin. That's the number. 81%. Their disapproval is 3%. So, yeah, it's a margin of 78%.
That's a huge number of people.
Republicans love Donald Trump. But the problem is Democrats do not. And more importantly, independent voters are a huge problem for Republicans. They are more split. Just 45%. 35. Just 35% approve of the job that the president is doing. 35% among independent voters, with 45% disapproving. So he's underwater among independents as well so far, and he's just getting started. Presidency is only a week old. But, you know, one of the reasons Republicans, as I cite that number of support among Republicans, that is something they may not they're going to look at closely, because they have gerrymandered this country within an inch of its life. And so many Congress members don't have to worry if they have an unpopular president, because as long as among Republicans that they have gerrymandered into their districts, they're fine. They're fine. There won't be blowback as long as Republican support holds out in many of these congressional districts. However, many of these congressional districts are quickly being unwound at this point. On Friday of last week, the same day as Trump's inauguration, a federal court ruled that 12 of Alabama's legislative districts were unconstitutional due to an improper use of race in their composition. A three-judge panel on the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals enjoined the use of the districts for future elections. They wrote, in a separate order that they expect the Alabama legislature to address the issue with the districts before the 2018 state elections, with the hope that the court's intervention would not be necessary. The legislative Black Caucus in Alabama and the Alabama Democratic Committee sued to overturn the maps that were drawn by the legislature in 2012. And nonetheless, here we are in, what year is this? 2017. How many elections have we had with these deliberately drawn
racially discriminatory
maps? That's right. And that was something that, so back in, it was done in 2012. And what apparently what it did was the Republican-controlled legislature deliberately moved Black voters who tend to vote for Democratic candidates into districts that prevented them from forming alliances with like-minded white voters, thus muting their voices in the process. That was the argument they made and the argument that was accepted by the three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit.
So the 11th Circuit then accepted that the Black voters for 5 years were all kettled into pretty much one place,
yep,
diluting their vote.
Yep. The judges overall ruled that 9 House and 3 Senate districts were unconstitutional. Those were in state elections in Alabama. But this is something that we have seen now in a number of states, one after another. Today, in Wisconsin, just a couple of weeks ago, the same thing was found in the state of Wisconsin. And after striking down those legislative maps as unconstitutional, this was 2 months ago in Wisconsin, a federal court today ordered Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and lawmakers to redraw the legislative maps by November 1 to ensure they will be used. Those new maps will be used in the fall 2018 elections. Again, a three-judge panel rejected the state's request, which is run by Republicans, to wait until the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed in on this case. But the panel also denied a request by the Democratic plaintiffs that the court draw the maps. They want the court to draw it, not the Republicans in the state legislature. But that was rejected. The judges said that that this was a task better left to the state's GOP-controlled legislature, and Scott Walker saying that there was no evidence that they would not comply with the order to redraw these districts in a way that was not a racial or partisan gerrymander.
Except for the evidence that they already did it once.
Yeah, but now instructed. They were caught,
yeah,
and
they've been instructed
to not do it.
But if they redraw it again, then that means that they could get away with it again, and then they'd have to go through a whole process of another lawsuit all over again.
Yeah, checks and balances sucks, doesn't it?
It takes time.
It does. So there's some good news. Bill Whitford, the lead plaintiff in the case that was brought by Fair Elections Project, said today is a good day for Wisconsin voters, another step in the journey of ensuring that our voices are heard. Well, take your time. So, of course, the result of this is that Democrats in the state of Wisconsin only hold about a third of the seats in both the state assembly and the state Senate. And, of course, Republicans hold the executive branch. And it's not only and conservatives have a 5-2 edge now on the state Supreme Court. It's not only that they've redrawn these districts, but the Democratic Party in Wisconsin needs some work big time. And Wisconsin is not the only one where Democrats need to step up at the state level. David Haynes, the editorial page editor for the Journal Sentinel in Milwaukee, notes today that to win, you have to actually put up candidates. He notes the Democrats are the organization that couldn't be bothered to recruit a candidate to take on conservative state Supreme Court Justice Annette Ziegler. Or to find, this was just in 2016, or find challengers to take on Walker appointees for circuit court seats in, he says, wait for it, in Milwaukee County, one of the two most Democratic counties in the state. What the hell is going on there, Wisconsin Democratic Party? I point that out as good news because it is good news that those districts are going to be redrawn, and I'd like to think it's good news that now you know, voters in Wisconsin, you need to hold those Democrats accountable. You need to get involved in your state, local and state elections. Don't leave it to the Democratic Party. All right. The newly minted U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She showed up for her first day on the job at UN headquarters in New York City today. She made a statement to the press before heading up to a meeting with the also new Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres.
Is that Guterres.
Guterres. Haley outlined the new U.S. approach to the UN in what the AP describes as, quote, blunt language with none of the diplomatic nuances characteristic of discussions at the UN. Yeah, I'll say. She doesn't have any. She has no foreign policy experience whatsoever.
None.
Nikki Haley.
Right.
And yet she's now in charge of, she's now the UN ambassador for the U.S. She promised to, yes, take names of those that don't have our back.
There is a new U.S. UN. We talked to the staff yesterday, and you are going to see a change in the way we do business. It's no longer about working harder. It's about working smarter. And we have a fantastic team at the USUN that's ready to prove that. Our goal with the administration is to show value at the UN. And the way that we'll show value is to show our strength, show our voice, have the backs of our allies, and make sure that our allies have our back as well. For those that don't have our back, we're taking names. We will make points to respond to that accordingly. But this is a time of strength. This is a time of action. This is a time of getting things done, and this administration is prepared and ready to go in, to have me go in, look at the UN, and everything that's working, we're going to make it better. Everything that's not working, we're going to try and fix, and anything that is seems to be obsolete and not necessary, we're going to do away with. But this is a time of fresh eyes, new strength, new vision, and a great day at the USUN. Thank you very much.
That was now U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, saying that we're going to take names, we're going to have strength, we're going to take action. So basically, using this body that has been created for peace to essentially go in and make a call for war, it sounds
kinda like. Kind of like going in like a bully and saying, all right, anybody who is not with me is against me. And right. I'll be coming after you.
Right. If you're not in favor of peace, damn it, we're going to crush you.
Something like that, yeah. And the Bush administration, not the Bush administration, I'm sorry, that was me going back in time.
Yeah, Freudian slip.
Yeah, the new Trump administration.
You wish it was the Bush administration.
Had been talking about cutting the United Nations budget, the U.S. contribution to the United Nations budget. The U.S. contributes about 25% of the overall operations. And you know, the Republicans have been wanting to cut the U.N. funding for years now. So it looks like they're going to try to get their chance.
On Friday as well, in a very short, his first ever presidential press conference with a foreign leader, Donald Trump would not say whether he favors lifting sanctions imposed on Russia. His British counterpart, UK Prime Minister Theresa May, was with him there, and she explicitly rejected lifting those sanctions. She also declared that Trump had told her in their meeting with that NATO had his full support. That's what Donald Trump said to her in the private meeting, and she said it out loud. Trump also addressed whether he plans to order the U.S. military to reinstate so-called enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding. Yes, that would be torture. That would be war crimes. Those would be violations of the Geneva Conventions. Those, of course, were instituted by the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, later halted under President Obama. In the Friday press conference, however, foreign journalists pressed Trump multiple times about the use of torture. And he said that while he supports torture, which is amazing in and of itself. The good news here, and yes, again, we're looking for good news today. The good news here is that he would defer to his new defense secretary, General James Mattis, who says that he does not support torture.
We have a great general who has just been appointed Secretary of Defense, General James Mattis. And he has stated publicly that he does not necessarily believe in torture or waterboarding or however you want to define it. Enhanced interrogation, I guess, would be a word that a lot of people would like to use.
Not me.
I don't necessarily agree, but I would tell you that he will override because I'm giving him that power. He's an expert. He's highly respected. He's the general's general. Got through the Senate very, very quickly, which in this country is not easy, I will tell you. So I'm going to rely on him. I happen to feel that it does work. I've been open about that for a long period of time. But I am going with our leaders. And we're going to win with or without. But I do disagree.
Unclear what we're going to win, but good news, right? He's not going to allow torture.
As long as Mattis doesn't allow it,
as long as Mattis stays in charge, as long as he doesn't fire Mattis. So, again, I realize, I can't sugarcoat any of this, and I realize it's a pretty low bar, but hey, there's some good news.
That is
no
good
torture.
News.
By the way, not easy to get through the Senate. So far, pretty easy to get through the Senate. Democrats have not been voting against these people at all. And in some cases, there might be good reason to not vote against them. But I know that the Democratic base really wants to see a show of resistance against this president. And frankly, as long as the Republicans can get these people through without a single Democratic vote, it's kind of unclear why Democrats continue to vote for Donald Trump's nominees. But that's a subject for another day. We'll hold this other story as well because I want to get to my guest here for some more good news. Maybe, kind of. We'll see. Maybe good news for fans of healthcare. And I know we have them out there. I know there's a lot of our listeners are in favor of healthcare. So maybe some good news here, even if the worst happens to Obamacare. At least if we can take anything from the Australian example of what happened to their national healthcare system. That story with my guest John Judas is coming up next. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Yeah. Feeling better already. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The utter confusion among GOPers right now continues regarding their long-promised plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Republican lawmakers in Congress seem to have the repeal part largely underway, but they don't seem to have any actual plan yet, at least not one that they agree upon, to replace former President Obama's landmark health care insurance reform law, which resulted in access to health care for some 20 million Americans, the slowest growth in health care rates in decades, and the lowest uninsured rate in American history. Other than that, as both Trump and Republicans like to say, it's a disaster. A recently released report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office stated that that repealing the Affordable Care Act without a replacement could cost 32 million people to lose their insurance. This, understandably, has caused a great deal of angst amongst both those who currently rely on the provisions of Obamacare for their health care, as well as many of those who provide those services, like nurses and doctors, as this new ad, launched on Thursday by healthcare advocacy group Alliance for Healthcare Security, explains.
Congress has taken the first step to rip apart our healthcare with no plan to replace it.
They don't have a plan to ensure the 30 million people who will lose their healthcare.
No plan to cover pre-existing conditions like cancer.
No plan to keep insurance rates from skyrocketing.
Everybody's costs will go up.
It's going to cause pain.
Repealing health care with no plan to replace it is going to hurt all of us. Tell Congress we need a plan that protects our care.
Well, that's cheery. Despite the confusion about what to replace the Obamacare with, Donald Trump and his steadfast GOP partners in the House and Senate, and make no mistake, they are steadfast and they are partners. Those folks in the House and Senate remain hell-bent on replacing the law, even if it results in extraordinary hardship for a huge swath of the American public. But as we are continually looking for light and hope somehow and somewhere at the end of this seemingly nightmarish tunnel. Author and journalist John Judis posited the possibility at Talking Points Memo recently that even if Obamacare is gutted, the political pushback may result in a much better healthcare plan, healthcare law for Americans, at least eventually. If Trump guts Obamacare, history may repeat itself. The Australian lesson. That's the headline of Judis's recent piece. Joining us now to explain that lesson is John Judis. He's a journalist, author, and editor-at-large for TalkingPointsMemo.com. He formerly worked at The New Republic for about 25 years, and his articles have appeared in The American Prospect, New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, Washington Monthly, American Enterprise, Mother Jones, and Dissent. He's also the author of 7 books. His latest, published last October and presciently titled The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. John Judis, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for having me.
John, I don't know if I'm just grasping at straws here, or maybe if you are, but I was a little bit encouraged by your short piece at TPM recently on this, so thank you at least for that. But so before we get to the possible hope that you describe as the Australian lesson, explain what happened with Australia's initial national health insurance system back in the early 70s and the similarities to how the conservatives down there in Australia undermined that law the way Republicans have been working so hard to undermine Obamacare for the past 6 years since its passage here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, this is what I understand happened. There was a Labor government in the early 1970s, mm-hmm. and it passed a national health insurance law that operated somewhat like Medicare, but with this difference: if people didn't want to go through the public system, they could buy it privately and they wouldn't have to pay taxes. So you could opt out of it. There wasn't a mandate in that sense. And then there was the question of how it was going to be financed. Was there going to be a special tax levy that would support the program? The Liberal Party, and liberal doesn't mean the same thing in Australia as it does in the United States. It's mm-hmm. closer to what we in the 19th century used to call liberals, free market people.
Okay.
We call them conservatives now. The Liberal Party in Australia controlled most of the state legislatures, there's mm-hmm. 6 in there, like function like our state, uh-huh. and also the upper house of their legislature. So they were able to cripple the law by denying a means to tax it. So taxes for it, the revenue for it, would have to come out of general revenue. So that was one big pressure on it. Why should we keep paying for this thing, you know, especially the people who were buying private insurance? The doctors were opposed to it, so they started jacking up their rates to the point where it was very hard for what was like their national health insurance system to pay the rates. And that itself created a lot of pressure upon both doctors, hospitals, and upon patients. And then finally they had a big recession in 1981, like we did, and the Labor Party was voted out, conservatives came in, and they just repealed the damn thing.
It sounds very similar, and I think that initial program in Australia was called Medibank. And so that was enacted in the same way. It was lawfully enacted by the parliament. Its implementation was undermined by right wing legislators and legislatures around the nation. And you had the medical establishment itself, in that case, as you described, John, Australian doctors jacking up the prices. That's somewhat akin. I don't know if we've seen that, but we've seen for-profit health insurance companies in the U.S. clearly trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act, and that was that. And
when you said this, and I'm not a health expert, mm-hmm. I'm not
right,
but I'm not, you know, I think the problem was that they are for-profit health companies, not so much that they were especially trying to undermine. I think they, in lots of ways, thought that they were going to profit by it. But Republicans in Congress cut the subsidies to the health insurance companies when they'd have to take too many risky patients on mm-hmm. to insure. So they really haven't been making the kind of profit rates that they expected. So it's, again, I think a lot of it was undermined by the Republicans in Congress. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how much you can blame the insurance companies or the doctors for it in our case.
I'm thinking back to, and I know actually neither you or I are experts on this particular point, but I know that Aetna, for example, I think it was Aetna, was, you know, threatening to pull out of various markets unless they got this or that. They were working for a merger.
Correct.
And so, in other words, it was left. They weren't working in the same way with the program. They had problems with it. They were using it for their own purposes rather than a national system in which they have no choice but to use it. And it sounds similar. I'm just looking at the parallels there that resulted in effectively killing Medibank and could end up killing Obamacare. All right, so let's move the clock forward a little bit. The public eventually, as you said, turned on those. Were they specifically turning on the lawmakers in Australia, as you understand it, for putting that in place, or was it for putting that Medibank in place originally, or was it just part of disenchantment overall with the Labor, which is actually the left government at the time in the early 80s?
I think it was all those factors. I think it was again, to the extent that I'm not an expert in healthcare politics, mm-hmm. I'm really not an expert in Australia, but I think both factors were involved. Just disenchantment with the party in power, given that a recession had come, and also the feeling that the national health thing was not working. It was costing too much.
So it goes to the government goes to the conservatives, but then the pendulum eventually swung back to a...
Very quickly. Yes, because people figured, I know this too because I've had experience of not having health insurance. You have this incredible anxiety. Mm. And but 1983, mm-hmm. the conservatives get voted out. Labor comes in, and this time they put in a new system that's taxed specially. There aren't opt-outs the way there were with the old system. It's called Medicare, and it works. You know, they also were in control of most of the legislatures then, so nobody could undermine it. And they've had conservative liberal governments, so-called, since then.
Mm-hmm.
But the system is still in place, and it's popular. So they got a system finally that didn't have the flaws of the early one. I think it's interesting just because the system was undermined in a similar way,
mm-hmm.
the first system, to the way that the American system was undermined. In my wildest dreams, I don't know whether we could get a kind of a Medicare like the Australians get after our own, mm-hmm. If the Republicans end up destroying Obamacare. So,
well, I think the parallel that interested me was the fact that, they had a system, it was undermined, and then the pushback eventually resulted in a stronger health care law, or at least certainly in that case, it was a stronger health care law. But the idea that the public, after seeing this killed, came and demanded a better program, which you note in your piece that in the U.S., support for a national health insurance program of some type is always very high when we don't have it. You say that it helped the Democrats win the White House in 92 and in 2008. But then when the American people get an administration who actually wants to implement it, suddenly those policies are not so popular. And you further argue that if the Republicans do gut Obamacare, then interest once again in a national health insurance will revive. What makes you so sure about that? And how do we explain the fact that Americans want this, and then when they're actually going to be given it, they all of a sudden turn against it?
Well, it's not hard to explain why they want it, because, as I said, there's a very basic anxiety that people begin to feel about their insurance. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be greater now than it was 10, 20 years ago, because there's more churning in the job market. People are more worried about losing their job and then losing their insurance. I think if the Republicans really kill Obamacare without replacing it with anything viable, you will see a political revolt in the country.
Do you think that support for health care or a program like this, you say it, you know, falters whenever these folks come in place? What explains that? Is it just the PR that's run against it by Republicans and so forth?
This is something that really you need to know this system better than I do. But look, the problem that we have in America is, let's say, number one, skepticism about government to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we have a health system which is already rococo. It's so intertwined. There's so many elements mm-hmm. in it that would have to be changed before we could get to something like what the Australians had with Medicare. For instance, we have people getting insurance from their employer, and they get all kinds of different insurance at different levels. We have all these insurance companies. Things were a lot simpler like 50 or 60 years ago. We could have done this a lot more easily. But now you really have to take a wrecking ball to the insurance industry. You have to end the relationship between employers and employees getting insurance, upon which, you know, a lot of unions mm-hmm. pride themselves, in order to get a system, I think, that would really work, where everybody, when they were born in the United States, when they're American citizens, would get a card and they'd have insurance, and they'd have to pay for it. They pay for it either taxes, premiums, or whatever, but there wouldn't be this crazy anxiety. You know, even to get Obamacare now, you have to have a degree in business administration
yeah.
to figure out all the damn choices.
Right.
I had that much trouble with Medicare recently, signing up for things and, you know, periods when you can enroll, periods when you can't enroll. I was 8 days late. So, again, what I would look for in the future in this ideal utopian community would be something that, again, is very common in Europe, where you are born with the right to health insurance. If you're not a citizen, I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which you, you know, might not qualify, but citizens would get a right to health care. They'd have to pay for it. The amount they'd have to pay for it would be limited by their income. And that would be it. It would be off the board. People wouldn't have to worry about it.
And you cite
the way they don't have to worry about, you know, going absolutely mm-hmm. broke when they turn 65 now. But I'm just saying, I think
yeah.
that if you remember the Clinton plan, again, you didn't even need you needed more than a master's degree. You needed a doctorate to understand the HIPICs, the health. Well, what they call them, the health something or other.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredibly complicated program.
You point to the Swiss, and they have a national system in your article at Talking Points Memo. The Swiss, which has a very simple system, and you say that Democrats now need to essentially they need to be ready when the pendulum swings back, if it swings back, as you see from the Australian lesson, and which I think many of us hope happens here. So that requires Democrats to get their act together and sort of coalesce around a system that would be more popular with the American electorate this time. Is that Is that possible? Is that in the cards for Democrats?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope it's possible. I mean, Bernie Sanders ran on Medicare for All. Now, mm-hmm. that, again, would require a lot of taking a wrecking ball to some institutions. Maybe the private health insurance companies would feel that it's no longer profitable and they could, you know, might want to get into something else. But what I mentioned the Swiss model for was that you could have nonprofit insurance companies mm-hmm. like Blue Cross Blue Shield that offered the insurance as long as it was tightly regulated and as long as everybody had to have it and as long as the amount of income that you put into it was limited. So, you know, it can work. You don't have to eliminate insurance companies.
Well,
I think you do have to eliminate for-profit insurance companies.
And again, not, you know, I don't want to get into the debate about how to do this necessarily. I guess the question is, you know, will the Democrats be able to figure out that clear plan? But what you're highlighting here in pointing to Australia essentially is, if I understand it, John Judas, the political pendulum, essentially. And it's painful, of course, when it swings in the direction for your opponents. But does history show in the U.S., like what we see in Australia, does the history show that when the pendulum swings back, that it often results in better, more progressive policies over time, you know, above and beyond healthcare even? Just looking for some hope here, John.
Social Security was a very limited system in 1935. It didn't cover mm-hmm. farmers, for instance, small farmers, an exemption that the South got because they didn't want it to mm-hmm. cover blacks. It didn't cover all kinds of workers. The benefits were much more limited. And it was basically reformed and improved by successive administrations. And the two that did the most were Eisenhower and Nixon, Republicans. So, you know, you get a system that's basically popular, and you can do a lot of things with it. The problem with health care is we haven't started with a base system that everybody supports and says, well, you know, it's got a few problems, let's fix them. I think it's possible to improve things. It's just we're in a difficult situation politically, very polarized, very skeptical about government. So it might take, on the one hand, the collapse of our current health system, and secondly, a political kind of crisis that would give the Democrats the kind of big majorities they'd need to make dramatic changes.
I looks like we're heading towards both, to be frank. Before I let you go, John, your latest book, The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. I apologize for not having read it, but the title, and I know it came out before the election, actually in October, the title seems quite prescient. In retrospect, was the pendulum swinging back, or at least swinging towards Trump and his at least pretend populism, was that much more predictable last year than so many regarded it in the year or two leading up to his election, as you see it?
Last year was 2016. I started the book in the summer of 2015, and I had seen Trump in New Hampshire in August mm-hmm. of 2015, and I saw him, and the little bell went off in my head, Ross Perot. Mm-hmm. And it was at a high school, and people were lined up, it was like mm-hmm. the movie premiere of Godfather 2, lines stretching way out into the highways. And, it was clear something was happening, and it was also clear by then that something was happening with Sanders. I didn't expect either of them to go as far as they did, but, by the time I started the book, and I wrote it pretty quickly, things in Europe and things in the United States were both percolating.
John Judas, author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. He's also the editor-at-large for TalkingPointsMemo.com and recently offered what I'm going to choose, John, to see as a hopeful article headlined, If Trump Guts Obamacare, History May Repeat Itself, The Australian Lesson. John, always good to, and helpful talking to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right, a quick break. We're back with a few more items here. And yes, some good news, I think, in all of them. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast.
It's all in the air. You hear it everywhere. No matter what you do, it's gonna grab a hold on you.
It might.
California soul.
Yep. Welcome back.
California soul.
Welcome back to The Bradcast. From California. A lot of California soul here. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Desi Doyen, you had a point you wanted to make, a couple of dots you wanted to connect from that interview with John Judas.
Yes, an observation. John Judas had mentioned how in Australia, when it came time for the Labor Party to reinstate and reanimate their healthcare system, mm-hmm. that it was they had control of the state legislatures that then were prevented from undermining it because they were with the same party. So when you mention at the beginning that Wisconsin now has this new requirement to redistrict because of heavy gerrymandering, that hey, Democrats, why didn't you challenge people in all of these races? You know, it's the state legislatures where a lot of this action happens.
Wisconsin and Alabama, and I forgot to mention North Carolina. They also were found to have the Republicans there to have racially gerrymandered their districts, about 28 of them. They were ordered to hold a new election this year in 2017. I think that has now been actually put on hold. While it's being challenged at the Supreme Court, so it may the election, this special election that had been ordered, may not happen in 2017, but it's going to happen there as well. And yeah,
the point is, there's a lot of action happening at your state level, and get involved in what's happening with your state legislatures. They draw the boundaries, the districts.
Indeed, they do. And so I want to get to a California story in a second, but I just want to hit this real quick, if it's even possible to hit this real quick. But at least four senior officials in Trump's White House have active accounts on a private Republican National Committee email system, at least according to a new report in Newsweek. Counselor Kellyanne Conway, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, Chief Strategist and Senior Counselor Steve Bannon, and Senior Advisor Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, all have email accounts on rnchq.org, which is run by the RNC. Now, Trump, you may recall, had repeatedly attacked his opponent, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, last year for using a private email server, and yet Conway, Spicer, Bannon, Kushner, all using private email in the White House. So, yeah, you know, they don't actually care. You think? The use of separate political email accounts at the White House is not actually illegal. So they could do that. They could use a separate account as long as they keep business separate from personal and political business. The disclosure requirement for official business conducted using electronic messaging accounts, apparently that's a rule or a law, stipulates that if the White House staffers have already used private accounts like the RNC ones, that they must copy or forward those communications into the government system within 20 days. We will see if they do that. That was a law that was passed in 2014 to prevent presidents from shielding communications that fall under the Presidential Records Act of 1979, which was put in place after the problems with the Nixon administration. That rnchq.org email system, that is the same one that caused problems during the George W. Bush administration when they claimed to have lost 22 million Bush administration emails. And at that time, of course, Republicans didn't care because it was a Republican administration. Now they were furious about Hillary Clinton having a private email server, despite the fact that she turned over most of the emails. And yes, she made the decision about which ones were private and which ones were work related. And so that's where the problem started. But they didn't care when 22 million Bush administration emails completely disappeared. That RNC HQ.org account, by the way, is hosted on the same commercial server as it was during the Bush years. Place down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, called Smart Tech. That name may ring a bell for some longtime Brad blog readers and Bradcast listeners. That was the server that, in the middle of the night, in 2004 during the presidential election, in the middle of the night, the results from the election, the presidential election in Ohio, suddenly moved from Ohio down to this Smart Tech server in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they house, among other things, rnchq.org and georgewbush.org and all of that. And when those results suddenly, the server had gone down in Ohio, John Kerry was winning at the time, according to the results, and then suddenly the computers went out, came back up down in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Voila!
George W. Bush was winning. So there's a little little reminder for you, a little blast from the past.
About the same server.
Yep, the same exact one. And George W. Bush's ethics lawyer, Richard Painter, says the RNC email system, according to the U.S. intelligence, was hacked during the 2016 race. So Painter says they better be careful after making such a huge ruckus over the private email over at the State Department, says George W. Bush's ethics attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Since the report came out, and this is why it's a good news story, since this report came out from Newsweek a day or two ago, Kellyanne Conway, Jared Kushner, Sean Spicer, and Steve Bannon have all shut down, reportedly have shut down, their rnchq.org private server email addresses, email accounts. At least that's what they say. I think they'll still have to turn over whatever emails they might have sent on those accounts before they shut them down. But the good news here is, yes, public pressure, the media, the press, it works. It works to change things. It works to make things better. That despite Steve Bannon's attack on the press yesterday, telling them to keep their mouths shut. Of course, he would love that because it wouldn't, if only the press kept their mouth shut, they wouldn't reveal that Steve Bannon had a private email account in the White House, that Steve Bannon is registered in two separate states, that Steve Bannon seems actually to have committed voter registration fraud in the state of Florida. So, yeah, they don't care for the media. For understandable reasons, perhaps. All right, here's one more story, and we'll let you decide if this is a good one or not. I get these announcements from the California Secretary of State whenever a statewide ballot proposition enters circulation for signatures, for petition gathering to try and end up on the ballot. Well, there's this. This is the first one I've received that I've noticed in 2017. The first one that I've received since the 2016 election.
From the California Secretary of State?
From the California Secretary of
All
State.
Right.
This initiative is titled California Nationhood Initiative, Constitutional Amendment and Statute. If successful, if this gets onto the ballot, it repeals provision in California Constitution stating California is an inseparable part of the United States and that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It would remove that from the California Constitution. And it places a question of whether California should become a separate country onto a future ballot. So it would, in the first case, it would remove the business from the California Constitution that regards the U.S. as the supreme law of the land, and then it sets up a second vote in, I think, in 2019. This future vote would allow, would be a declaration of independence from the United States. If 50% of registered voters participate in that election, and if 55% of those voting approve. So that could happen. This is actually a thing that is moving forward. Right now, the proponent of the measure, a guy by the name of Marcus Evans, he must collect about 585,000 signatures from registered voters. That would be 8% of the total votes cast for governor in the November 2014 general election. That's what he has to do in order to qualify for the ballot. He has 180 days now to circulate petitions for the measure, which are being circulated at yescalifornia.org for those who might be interested in separating from the United States.
And they're calling that, of course, Cal Exit.
Yep.
After Brexit.
And I'm not sure how I feel about that. California is, of course, the sixth largest economy in the world if taken just by itself. Larger economy, for example, than the country of France. So yescalifornia.org, you can print out petitions for signature gathering and so forth if you're in California, if you'd like to help this effort, if you think it's a good idea. I don't know if it is or not. Ask me after week two of this presidency. I suspect we'll talk about it more in the future. But I know that if we do separate out here from the rest of the country, I want to build a beautiful wall.
With a big door.
All along the border. I'm not sure about the door yet, but well, it'll be a big wall all along the border to help keep those rapists from Arizona from coming into California. That's some I assume are good people. I'm still not sure that
they're sending us their best people.
I don't think they are. So keep that in mind. All right. We will be back with you next time for another thrilling episode of the broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest, John Judas from TPM, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of this program or any other, you can download all the broadcasts you can eat at bradblog.com, where we are celebrating our 12th anniversary of troublemaking and muckraking as we head into our lucky 13th year.
Hoo-wee.
Thanks to those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue doing exactly that. We really need your help, and we are mighty grateful for it. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find, follow, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. That is it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Like a sound you hear that lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it in